well, well. Look who's come crawling back. It's you. You've come back for part three of our sub-series here on 365 Honest Questions About the Bible, whom of which I am the host of, your long-suffering host, in fact, Dante Stack. And yes, today we are doing our third part of our sub-series, God of Gods, that tries to specifically hone in on the supernatural, the heavenly realms of creation and history. If you're a completionist and you need every episode of 365 to have its own individual question, this counts as question 81. What does it mean to be a son of God or a son of man? And we're going to try to answer that question pretty quickly here. But guys, I know, thanks for sticking with this series so far. We've kind of been in the weeds a lot, at least for me. I like the big picture stuff, so getting into the nitty-gritty of the definition of words and looking at every instance of the word angel in the Bible is a little bit weathering the storm for me. I want the big picture, the big payoff. I don't want to spend my time dividing the atom. Actually, that's really cool. I like subatomic particles and stuff. So, scratch that comment. Pulling weeds? Anyway, some other analogy. By the way, this episode, unless I do it spur of the moment, this episode's gonna have no movie references. That's because we've got too much to accomplish today. I think today is the first fruits of our labor, right? We've been working for two episodes, kind of just laying down the framework of the definition of terms and the occurrences of Elohim and sons of God and angels and what all that means in its substructure. That's the foundation of our house. Today, we get the first fruits of, a revelation of sorts. And, you know, I'm not trailblazing here. I'm not uncovering lost truths that no one has seen in the Bible for thousands of years. That's not me. That's not who I am. I'm not going to be the guy that uncovers that stuff. Because the guys that uncover that stuff is some nerd that can read 13 ancient languages, is very familiar with Ugaritic cuneiform, and likes to spend their afternoons in the hot 130 degree deserts of Iran, Iraq, and Qatar or something like that. Again, not me. Here I am, literally sitting in my closet, surrounded by couch cushions, which I've taken from my couch, literally pulled out of my couch, brought here into the closet to try to deaden the sound, and obviously a whole bunch of clothes. So it seems unlikely that I'm going to break a story about the Bible from this vantage point. That being said, for me, going on this journey, there's revelations for me, things that I'm discovering, maybe not for the first time even, but for the first time in a I am my own personal explorer type of way. Like, I'm sifting through these questions and not being told the answer by a textbook or by a pastor, but discovering the answers within the context of scripture itself. And for me, that holds a lot of weight. Just as in the first episode here of God of Gods, I freaked out because I stumbled upon this question that seemed like just a straight up contradiction. Today's the opposite side of the spectrum, or the flip side of that coin, where I'm discovering truth by my own labor. That sounds self-righteous, but I don't mean it that way. It is a much more pleasant and memorable thing to discover what I feel like is truth for yourself from the primary sources, from the text of the Bible in this case, than it is to hear it preached at you. It's like kinesthetic learning, right? I'm using all my senses to come to this avenue. So using my hands to build a volcano that I forget the chemicals you add to make those little paper mache volcanoes explode. That's way more memorable than just being told how volcanoes work. Anywho, I think we have the first fruits here. It's exciting to me. We do have to do a little bit more legwork to get there, but we'll get there by the end of today's episode. And there's going to be at least several more episodes in this sub-series. Again, we're still at the tip of the iceberg, or the bottom of the mansion that we're building. So we're working up. Thank you. First Foundations. What have we covered so far? In episode 1, we looked at the names of God, kind of honing in specifically on the most frequently used word, which is Elohim. And I made the case that Elohim cannot just mean God. That doesn't fit. There's various usages of that word that don't fit that description. And in fact, the only way I could come up with to describe the word Elohim is to say something like heavenly creature, heavenly being. Or maybe I should be even less specific and say non-earthbound beings. And that extraterrestrials could be Elohim, right? But for the sake of brevity-ish, let's call Elohim heavenly beings. Or supernatural beings. That also fits. That was our takeaway from week 1. Week 2, episode 2, question 2, we examined the word angels, right? And specifically, I was trying to debunk this idea that all supernatural beings that aren't God are angels. And I made that point because it just doesn't seem to stand up to reason when you're looking at all the usages, once again, of the word angel in the Old and New Testaments, and the demons, the quote-unquote fallen angels, are never called fallen angels or angels. In fact, cherubim and seraphim, the supposed high classes of angels, are also never called angels in and of themselves. And also, humans are often referred to as angels. About half the time in the Old Testament, when we see the word angel, it is referring to a human, an Israelite, or someone else who is simply transferring a message from one location to another. Angels are the postal workers of the ancient world. So then, our modern idea of what an angel is, this supernatural creation of God, doesn't quite fit. What we used to call angels, I'm now saying most of the time we should probably call Elohim, which our Bible translates as God or gods. We're trying to strip the meaning of these words and get to the core of what they mean. So, Elohim, gods. Angels, messengers. That's all that word means. Messengers. All right, get it? Got it? Good. Let's get into this today. We're focusing in on the terms sons of God and sons of man. How does that interplay with our definitions? So we're going to have to define those terms and see how they play and intermingle with these other terms in our new playground, sandbox, if you will. Here we go. Sons of God shows up 3 times in the Old Testament. We're going to ignore one type because I want to keep it hidden away from you for a bit longer. It's exciting, intriguing, and full of and full of surprises. So that's not going to be for this week. So ignore what's behind box number 3. But box numbers 1 and 2, I'm sure if you've spent any time in churches growing up, you're familiar with. Box number 1, first time we see the phrase sons of God show up in the Bible is Genesis chapter 6. This is the Noah chapter, flood chapter, which also means it's the chapter where we see Nephilim show up and mighty men of valor. And most importantly, the sons of God come into the daughters of man. Now, of course, there's been tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of arguments between scholars about what this term sons of God mean. For lack of a better word, I'll say conservative scholars like to say that sons of God mean non-Sethite people, people not born from the line of Seth, but rather the sons of Cain. I don't buy it. On the main premise that the other big box that needs to be revealed of when we see the word sons of God showing up in the Old Testament is Job chapter 1 and 2. Now, if you'll remember, Job is quite likely, or quite possibly, the oldest book of the Bible. We know this because the language is old, Job lives near the land of Ur, he's pre-Israel, so this story is a very old story, predates, you know, the notion of Israel and the Israelites. I heard it recently said that most likely Job is wandering around about the time of Abraham. But of course, the story of Abraham is codified in the Torah, which most people think Moses put together. Moses being several hundred years after Abraham. So anyway, all that's to say, Job's an old book. And if you're not familiar with Job, it's a simple story. It's trying to answer the problem of suffering. Job is a righteous man, good in all his ways, and Satan shows up in heaven, surrounded by the sons of God. And he asks God, hey, Let me essentially torture your most righteous follower. God gives him Job. Satan makes a ton of bad things happen to Job. And then for 40-odd chapters, Job is wallowing in self-despair and trying to correlate how this good God that he worships would let him suffer like he has. The book, of course, ends with God showing up and having a direct discussion with Job, but we're not going to get so much into that, though we will reference Job a little later. The point is, the premise of the book starts with God in his heavenly realm and an accuser, Satan, showing up. And in this heavenly realm are the sons of God. Now, putting that aside for a second, sons of man. Sons of man shows up in the New Testament all the time. We'll talk about that in a sec. But the person who uses it the most is Ezekiel. Now, Ezekiel, unlike, say, Jeremiah, is a prophet who has several visions from God. And these visions often take him into the heavenly realm. And, you know, Ezekiel's the guy that alienologists are always like, look at Ezekiel 1. He's seeing alien spacecrafts because there's wheels within wheels spinning in outer space. He's seeing, you know, classic UFOs and is just using his ancient language to try to convey meaning of what he's actually seeing. The spinning discs with lights. You know, it's aliens, man, it's aliens. Anyway, Ezekiel calls himself a son of man. Okay, for brevity, for trying to move quickly here, I'm going to jump to a conclusion, and I hope you jump with me on it. Now, a son of God, that's Ben Elohim, a son of Elohim. Son of man is Ben Adam. The word man in Hebrew is just the word Adam. That's kind of fascinating. So we could, you know, easily translate the son of man as the son of Adam. And I think even saying it that way pulls in the meaning a little bit easier for us English speakers. Son of Adam, you are of mankind. Jesus, when he's super angry and he's shouting at the Pharisees, he calls them sons of the devil, their father, for they're liars. I don't think Jesus in that context is saying, Pharisees, the women who bore you out of their wombs, they're Satan. Your mothers are Satan. Turns out, you are literally the offspring of Satan. I don't think that's what he's saying. I think he's saying, you are of that ilk. You're of that predisposition. Just as in our tongue, when we call someone a son of a bee, or some many magnitudes less vindictive and evil sounding son of a gun, we're saying, your mother was a bad person, your mother was a B-word, so are you. You're of that nature. You're from bad stock. In essence, I think it's a colloquialism to say, that's what you are. You are this thing. A son of God is a son of an Elohim. And in essence, just saying, you are the Elohim type. And a son of man is a son of Adam. You are a mankind type. You are a human. It's not a super profound statement, but in Ezekiel, it's somewhat profound because here Ezekiel is seeing visions of heaven. He calls himself the son of man because he is different than all those things he's looking at. And this is quite apparent since he's staring at creatures with multiple eyes and lion head and eagle wings or whatever. He's staring at cherubim and wheels within wheels and all this crazy stuff. He's reminding himself, or maybe reminding us, he's a son of man. He's just like you and me. He is not of the same nature as those things. So, in conclusion, or jumping to my conclusion here, please come with me. Son of Elohim just means an Elohim. It means you're of the Elohim type. Son of man, or son of Adam, just means you are a man, or you are a human. Because what we see here is there's two classes. I believe this is coming out very clear, that the Bible's saying there's two creations, for lack of a better word. Two planes of existence. Maybe that's a better way to phrase it. Two planes of existence. There's our plane, the human plane of existence, and there's the heavenly existence. I'm moving my hand horizontally, vigorously right now to try to convey to you audio listeners only that there's two separate planes. Okay, that seems like a fairly straightforward point. I hope you're with me on that. So, once again, Genesis 6, I don't believe that the sons of God are non-Sethite people. That doesn't make any sense to me. But anywho, whether or not you buy into that particular premise is irrelevant today. Let's move on. God, Yahweh, Creator God Yahweh, God of gods Yahweh, is not like us. He makes this very clear in the Old Testament on multiple occasions. And I quote, Numbers 23:19, God is not man that he should lie, or a son of man that he should change his mind. Notice there, there's really no distinction between man and son of man. It has the same meaning here in this context. But God is saying, I am something other than you guys. Going back to Job here, I want to read a few verses. But to be clear, this is Bildad speaking, which is one of Job's friends. Now, Job's friends get a bad rap, and, you know, for good reason. Job is suffering, and three of his friends come to cheer him up or whatever, and they have this long-winded debate where essentially Job's friends are just attacking him, attacking him, attacking him. Job, you've screwed up. You're not righteous. You're not righteous. You're not righteous. You're holding back a lie. And Job just keeps affirming himself, saying, no, I am righteous. I haven't done anything wrong to deserve this. But his three friends continue to attack Job by speaking to the theology that they know. Now, I quote Bildad here, and you can take this with a grain of salt. Maybe you just throw out Bildad and say, well, he's wrong about everything, so why should I hold on to that? But I think Bildad is saying the theology of the time, which I think, to a degree, is the right theology. So, here we go. Job 25:1-6. Then Bildad the Shuhite answered Job and said, dominion and fear are with God. He makes peace in his high heaven. Is there any number to his armies? Upon whom does his light not arise? How then can man be in the right before God? How can he who is born of woman be pure? Behold, even the moon is not bright, and the stars are not pure in his eyes. How much less man who is a maggot, and the son of man who is a worm? See, once again, there the usage of man and son of man, pretty much synonymously. Man is a maggot, son of man is a worm. It's saying, God is not like us, God is pure, we are not. We're human folk, we're maggots in his eyes. In other words, there's a great chasm between God and us that makes us in no way ever seem superior to God or on equal footing with God. Also, I should note, the word for God here is Elohim. So, it is kind of interesting to restate it with the Elohim word. Dominion and fear are with Elohim. He makes peace in his high heaven. Interesting, right? Take a look also here, Exodus 3:1-7. This is the burning bush story. Moses' initiation, Moses' beginning bromance with God starts this way. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law, Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside to see this great sight, why this bush is not burned. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses, and he said, here I am. Then he said, do not come near, take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. Notice, it is the Lord, it's Yahweh, calling out to Moses, but it is the angel of the Lord that Moses sees. Why that's important is brought to our full attention later in Exodus 33. This is a weird story, but fascinating. It's a fun story. It's a weird, fun story. Exodus 33:12-23. Moses said to the Lord, Moses said to Yahweh, see, you say to me, bring up the people, but you have not let me know whom you will send with me. Yet you have said, I know you by name, and you have also found favor in my sight. Now therefore, if I have found favor in your sight, please show me your ways, that I may know you in order to find favor in your sight. Consider, too, that this nation is your people. And he said, my presence will go with you, and I will give you rest. And Moses said to him, if your presence will not go with me, do not bring us up from here. For how shall it be known that I have found favor in your sight, I and your people? Is it not in your going with us, so that we are distinct, I and your people, from every other people in the face of the earth? Here's the argument, right? Moses is saying, look, you're asking a lot from us, God. You're my buddy. I want you to physically be with us. You're saying, I'll be with you, but I know you're not literally going to be walking amongst us. We're not going to be able to see you and touch you and embrace you, but that's what I want. I at least want to see you myself, God. It's kind of a weird conversation. And then the story continues, verse 17. And the Lord, Yahweh, said to Moses, this very thing that you have spoken, I will do, for you have found favor in my sight, and I know you by name. Moses said, please show me your glory. Like, okay then, ante up. And he said, God, I will make all my goodness pass before you and will proclaim before you my name, the Lord, Yahweh. And I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and I will show mercy on whom I will show mercy. But, he said, you cannot see my face, for man shall not see me and live. And the Lord said, behold, there is a place by me where you shall stand on the rock, and while my glory passes by, I will put you in the cleft of the rock, and I will cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will take away my hand, you will see my back, but my face shall not be seen. Weird. Very weird. But the point is clear. God, Yahweh, cannot be seen by man and live. So there's a tension here. God cannot be seen by man and live. Therefore, man is not seen by God. In the Gospel of John, in his preamble, in the beginning of his Gospel, John makes it clear that this is true. John 1:18, no one has ever seen God. The only God who is at the Father's side, he has made him known. John's saying, no one's seen God, but the only God who is at the Father's side, read into that, Jesus, has made God the Father known. So that, although the wording is weird, is clear that John's saying, hey, there's God the Father, and there's God the Son. We'll call him, even though he's not saying that directly right here. The Son makes known the Father because we can't see the Father ever ourselves. Moses gets a weird back image of the Father, but that's as close as we get. We don't see the face. Now there's a tension here. We talked about the angel of the Lord, the messenger of Yahweh. He was in the burning bush, right? God speaks from the burning bush, but it's the messenger of God, the messenger of Yahweh, that Moses sees in the burning bush. I'm going to read this rather long story from Judges chapter 13. There's context, but the context isn't really that important to us, so let's just do it. Judges 13, verses 6 through 23. Then the woman came and told her husband, a man of God came to me, and his appearance was like the appearance of the angel of God. In this case, it's angel of Elohim. Very awesome. I did not ask him where he was from, and he did not tell me his name. But he said to me, behold, you shall conceive and bear a son. So then drink no wine or strong drink, and eat nothing unclean, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb to the day of his death. Then Manoah, the husband, prayed to Yahweh and said, O Lord, Yahweh, please let the man of God whom you sent come again to us and teach us what we are to do with the child who will be born. And Elohim listened to the voice of Manoah, and the angel of Elohim came again to the woman as she sat in the field. But Manoah, her husband, was not with her. So the woman ran quickly and told her husband, behold, the man who came to me the other day has appeared to me. And Manoah arose and went after his wife and came to the man and said to him, are you the man who spoke to this woman? And he said, I am. Dun dun dun. I am. And Manoah said, now when your words come true, what is to be the child's manner of life, and what is his mission? And the angel of Yahweh, interesting change there from angel of Elohim to angel of Yahweh, said to Manoah, of all that I said to the woman, let her be careful. She may not eat of anything that comes from the vine, neither let her drink wine or strong drink, or eat any unclean thing. All that I commanded her, let her observe. Manoah said to the angel of Yahweh, please let us detain you and prepare a young goat for you. And the angel of Yahweh said to Manoah, if you detain me, I will not eat of your food. But if you prepare a burnt offering, then offer it to Yahweh. For Manoah did not know that he was the angel of Yahweh. And Manoah said to the angel of Yahweh, what is your name, so that when your words come true, we may honor you? And the angel of Yahweh said to him, why do you ask my name, seeing it is wonderful? So Manoah took the young goat with the grain offering and offered it on the rock to Yahweh, to the one who works wonders. And Manoah and his wife were watching. And when the flame went upward toward heaven from the altar, the angel of Yahweh went up in the flame of the altar. Now Manoah and his wife were watching, and they fell on their faces to the ground. The angel of Yahweh appeared no more to Manoah and to his wife. Then Manoah knew that he was the angel of Yahweh. And Manoah said to his wife, we shall surely die, for we have seen God. But his wife said to him, if Yahweh had meant to kill us, he would not have accepted a burnt offering and a grain offering at our hands, or shown us all these things, or now announced to us such things as these. Okay, did you catch it? This is the angel of Yahweh, the same one that shows up in the burning bush, and in fact shows up 56 times in the Old Testament, always appearing or intervening. He is seen in the Old Testament. When Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are thrown into the fiery furnace in the book of Daniel, it is the angel of the Lord who's the fourth person in the furnace, the angel of Yahweh. Notice, too, the shift tone. At first, they think he's an angel of Elohim, a messenger of Elohim. But then later they discover he's not just a messenger of Elohim, he's a messenger of Yahweh. And then, at the end, Manoah says, "We're gonna die. We saw God. We saw Yahweh." And Yahweh says, "No one can see man or they die. We're not Moses, and Moses didn't even get to see Yahweh." His wife, though, says, "Look, if he was going to kill us, he was going to kill us. We're still alive right now. I think we're okay." So what's going on with this tension? How do we resolve this tension that God says, "Hey, I'm Elohim. I'm on this high plane of existence, and my plane of existence can't be seen by your plane of existence, son of Adam." And yet, the messenger of Yahweh, who is also worshipped as Yahweh, is seen multiple times in the Old Testament. Well, you probably know where I'm going. Jesus is the answer. But the closer we look at this, the cooler it gets. So there's been tons of movies and stuff. You know, I think there's at least two movies that are called Son of God that tell the gospel story of Jesus. And I would wager that Son of God is the most common term that we in the modern era apply to Jesus. The Christmas stories infused in our minds, so we know Jesus was born, and I don't know, maybe the strength of Christmas makes his Son of Godness all the more clear for us. And I've talked to people that struggle with the idea that Jesus is God because they're like, "Well, wait, no, he's the Son of God. He's some sort of Herculean character, right? A semi-God, partial deity. He's Son of God. He's not God. See? Whatever." Our jump to conclusion mat told us that a Son of God is a God. A Son of Elohim is an Elohim. But here's the weird thing. Son of God is never directly spoken of by Jesus. He never directly calls himself a Son of God. There's one instance where it appears that he's alluding to himself, calling himself Son of God. He says, "If I told you that I was the Son of God." He does say that one time, but it's in a tricky conversation, so I'm choosing not to spend time on that passage today. But it stands to reason that Jesus is called Son of God by everyone else. What he refers to himself the most as, the title that he prefers, seemingly, during his earthly ministry, is the phrase Son of Man. I read one commentary that said he uses it so much that it is essentially a pronoun, a personal pronoun. Instead of saying I, Jesus says the Son of Man. It's just the thing that comes out of his mouth the most often. Now, you can imagine that this would be a very inoffensive term to Jewish people, right? Jews believe there's one God, and he is holy. There's not a pantheon, there's not multiple gods, there's one Yahweh. And he said, we already quoted it, from Numbers 23:19, "God is not man, nor a son of man." So it sounds like Jesus is saying to all the people, "I'm a son of man, I'm a son of man, hey, I'm a son of man." Like Ezekiel, see, who saw visions of the heavenlies, but wasn't a heavenly thing. And if I'm a son of man, I cannot be God, right? Because God said, "I am not a man that I should lie. I am not a son of man that I should change my mind," right? He says that. God says that. So Jesus, being a son of man, cannot be God, right? Wrong. Early on in the book of Mark, we see how Jesus is using this term in a way that seems a little different, or blasphemous even. Jesus heals a paralytic in Mark chapter 2, and he says as he does this, Mark chapter 2 verse 10, "But that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins." That's the reason he heals the paralytic. What? That sounds very different than what everyone understands as the term Son of Man. So you have to kind of ask yourself, all right, Jesus, if you're saying you're something more than a Son of Man, why not just call yourself a Son of God? Why not do that? Take, for instance, the story of the demon-possessed men in Matthew chapter 8. Here's that story, verses 28 through 31. "And when Jesus came to the other side, to the country of the Gadarenes, two demon-possessed men met him, coming out of the tombs, so fierce no one could pass that way. And behold, they cried out, 'What have you to do with us, O Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time?' Now a herd of many pigs were feeding at some distance from them, and the demons begged him, saying, 'If you cast us out, send us into the herd of pigs.' And Jesus said to them, 'Go.'" Catch that. Demons, which we haven't defined in this series yet, but whatever the demons are, they call Jesus the Son of God. Okay. At the beginning, or actually maybe even before the beginning of Jesus' ministry on earth. He is tempted by Satan. Let's read that story real quick. It's the first 11 verses of Matthew chapter 4. Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. Spirit is another term we have not yet defined. And I don't know, that's going to be a tough one to cover. I don't know when we'll cover it, but I assume we will. And after fasting 40 days and 40 nights, Jesus was hungry. And the tempter came and said to him, "If you are the Son of God, command these stones to become loaves of bread." But Jesus answered, "It is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God." Then the devil took him to the holy city and set him on the pinnacle of the temple and said to him, "If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you, and on their hands they will bear you up, lest you strike your foot against a stone." Jesus said to him, "Again, it is written, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test." Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, "All these I will give you, if you will fall down and worship me." Then Jesus said to him, "Begone, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve." Then the devil left him, and behold, angels came and were ministering to him. So, Satan comes to Jesus, and the first two times he says, "If you are the Son of God," he's poking the wound and saying, "Look, I know you know that you're a son of man. I know you're a son of Adam. You're a human. But if you're a son of God on that higher plane, that plane that I'm on, by the way, then do this supernatural thing. Do that supernatural thing." Well, Jesus doesn't. And so the third time, Satan shows him his dominion. He says, "Look, everything, I have dominion over everything. Since you're not a son of God, since you're not Elohim, worship me, and I'll give it to you." Boom. Look at all that you could have. If Jesus is only a son of man, why wouldn't he take this Elohim, although he's not called Elohim here, I'm calling him that, this Elohim at his offer? Why wouldn't he? Of course, the answer is, Jesus is a son of God. The gospel writer John makes that very clear. At the end of his book, he says, "Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name." Jesus is the Son of God. So then, why does Jesus say he's the Son of Man? I think the answer is twofold. Reason number one, Jesus wants to make sure we understand that he is man. He is born of a woman. He is of our ilk. He's on our plane of existence. A son of man is a son of Adam. He is an Adam. He is one of us. That's what he's trying to tell us by saying, "I am a son of man." Secondly, he's drawing an allusion to Daniel chapter 7. In Daniel 7, Daniel has a vision, and it goes like this. He says, "I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a son of man, and he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed." One commentator I read said that this passage was the most discussed passage in all of Judaism, particularly in the intertestamental period. In the 400 years or so, or the last 100 years or so, before Jesus comes on the scene, this is what everybody's wondering about. Because, again, it seems like a contradiction. How can a son of man be given all authority, power, honor, all that stuff from God? I read one article from Postost.net, wherein the writer said that scholars have generally three interpretations of this passage. That this person that's like a son of man, that's given all dominion and authority, is either one, a symbolic figure that stands for all of Israel, that God's saying, "I'm going to give Israel all of my authority, power, glory, all that stuff." Two, that one like a son of man could be referring to Michael, the archangel, because it is like a son of man, not a son of man. And in Daniel chapter 10, when Gabriel shows up, he is said to have the appearance of a man, and in 10:16 has the likeness of a son of man. So that seems valid. And then the third interpretation is that this passage is referring to a specific individual Messiah that will come for Israel. a product of the seed of David. Some thought maybe this is Judas Maccabeus, who led the Jewish revolt against the Seleucid Empire. But Jesus makes sure that we know that he's invoking this. When he's captured in the middle of the night by the Jewish authorities, here's what happens. This is Matthew 26, verses 57 through 68. Then those who had seized Jesus led him to Caiaphas the high priest, where the scribes and the elders had gathered. And Peter was following him at a distance, as far as the courtyard of the high priest, and going inside, he sat with the guards to see the end. Now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking false testimony against Jesus that they might put him to death. But they found none, though many false witnesses came forward. At last two came forward and said, "This man said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days.'" And the high priest stood up and said, "Have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you?" But Jesus remained silent. And the high priest said to him, "I adjure you by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." There it is. The high priest asks, "Are you the Son of God?" Jesus said to him, "You have said so." See, Jesus is being almost duplicitous there. He's saying, "You say I'm the Son of God." He goes on to say, "But I tell you, from now on, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his robes and said, "He has uttered blasphemy. What further witnesses do we need? You have now heard his blasphemy. What is your judgment?" They answered, "He deserves death." Then they spit in his face and struck him, and some slapped him, saying, "Prophesy to us, you Christ. Who is it that struck you?" So it seems like Jesus is being coy by avoiding saying, "I am a Son of God." But then he says, "I am the Son of Man, seated on the right hand, and you'll see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven." This is a direct reference to Daniel 7. He's saying, "I am the one that comes in the likeness of the Son of Man, that God gives all authority, power, and dominion and glory forever and ever to." Finally, in the book of Revelation, verses 4 through 8, this is what happens. Jesus speaks to John, and he says, "Grace to you and peace from him who is, and who was, and who is to come, and from the seven spirits who are before his throne, and from Jesus Christ, the faithful witness, the firstborn of the dead, and the ruler of kings on earth. To him who loves us and has freed us from our sins by his blood and made us a kingdom, priests to his God and Father, to him be glory and dominion forever and ever. Amen. Behold, he is coming with the clouds, and every eye will see him, and those who pierced him, and all the tribes of the earth will wail on account of him. Even so, amen. I am the Alpha and the Omega, says the Lord God, who is and who was and who is to come, the Almighty." Jesus here in Revelation is saying, "I'm still coming, I'm still coming, I'm still coming on the cloud. I am the Son of Man, I am the Son of God. I am the only person in all of history that is both a Son of God and a Son of Man. I am on both of those planes. I am the angel of the Lord, the messenger of the Lord, the one that can be worshipped but can also be seen by man." So finally now, why is this important? Two reasons. The first we see as an urgent question in the Old Testament. 1 Samuel 2:25. "If one man sins against another, God will mediate for him. But if a man sins against the Lord, Yahweh, who can intercede for him?" It's an unanswered question. But then we see the question really fleshed out in the book of Job. Once again, I said, the book of Job may be the oldest manuscript of the entire Bible. I'm going to read the entire chapter 9 of the book of Job. It's long, but it's so good. It gets to the marrow of everything. So this is Job confronting his accusers, his three friends who keep saying, "You're unrighteous, Job." Here's Job's response here, chapter 9. "Then Job answered and said, 'Truly I know that it is so. But how can a man be in the right before God?'" The word God again, Elohim. "If one wished to contend with him, one could not answer him once in 1,000 times. He is wise in heart and mighty in strength, who has hardened himself against him and succeeded. He who removes mountains, and they know it not, when he overturns them in his anger, who shakes the earth out of its place and its pillars tremble, who commands the sun and it does not rise, who seals up the stars, who alone stretched out the heavens and trampled the waves of the sea, who made the Bear and Orion, the Pleiades, in the chambers of the south, who does great things beyond searching out, and marvelous things beyond number. Behold, he passes by me, and I see him not. He moves on, but I do not perceive him." See, you can't see God. No man can see God and live. "Behold, he snatches away. Who can turn him back? Who will say to him, 'What are you doing?' God will not turn back his anger. Beneath him bowed the helpers of Rahab." Ooh, that Rahab reference is weird.
not for today. How then can I answer him? How then can I answer Elohim, choosing my words with him? Though I am in the right, I cannot answer him. I must appeal for mercy to my accuser. If I summoned him and he answered me, I would not believe that he was listening to my voice. For he crushes me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. He will not let me get my breath, but fills me with bitterness. If it is a contest of strength, behold, he is mighty. If it is a matter of justice, who can summon him? Though I am in the right, my own mouth will condemn me. Though I am blameless, he would prove me perverse. I am blameless. I regard not myself. I loathe my life. It is all one. Therefore, I say, he destroys both the blameless and the wicked. When disaster brings sudden death, he mocks at the calamity of the innocent. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covers the faces of its judges. If it is not he, who then is it? It's beautiful in its truth, right? We've all been there. We've been to that moment of, like, why is this so broken? Why is the world so dark? He continues, my days are swifter than a runner. They flee away. They see no good. They go like skiffs of reed, like an eagle swooping on the prey. If I say, I will forget my complaint, I will put off my sad face and be of good cheer. I become afraid of all my suffering, for I know you will not hold me innocent. I shall be condemned. Why then do I labor in vain? If I wash myself with snow and cleanse my hands with lye, yet you will plunge me into a pit and my own clothes will abhor me. For he is not a man, as I am, that I might answer him, that we should come to trial together. There is no arbiter between us who might lay his hand on us both. Let him take away his rod from me, and let not the dread of him terrify me. Then I would speak without fear of him, for I am not so in myself. The key lies there in the last few verses. And there are later passages in Job where he brings this out a little further, but I chose this one. There is no arbiter between us who might lay his hand on us both. There's a chasm between the Elohim and the sons of man, and no one can put a hand on the Elohim and another hand on the sons of man and bring them together. There is no one. Job is wishing for there to be an arbiter. He's wishing for a mediator. He's wishing for a son of man and a son of God. And Jesus, finally, after so many thousands of years of echoes of Job, came and became the mediator between God and man. The second reason is just as beautiful. Jesus on the Sermon on the Mount. Remember it? The most beautiful words, I think, of all the Bible, perhaps. He begins, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Just imagine Job being all these. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Wait, what? No one can see God and live. But the pure in heart, Jesus is saying, will live. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. But wait, we're human. We can't be called sons of God. We're sons of man. We're not sons of God. But the mediator is bringing us to God. He's taking us through the chasm. Again, in his preamble to the gospel, John tries to make this clear. John 1:9-13. The true light, which gives light to everyone, was coming into the world. He's speaking of Jesus. He was in the world, and the world was made through him. Yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people didn't receive him. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. He's saying you're not going to be a son of Adam, of flesh and blood and this plane of existence. You're going to be a son of God, a son of Elohim, a partaker of that higher realm, that other plane of existence. Finally, later in his life, John writes a few letters. And in his first letter, chapter 3, he says this, see what kind of love the Father has given to us, that we should be called children of God. And so we are. The reason why the world does not know us is that it did not know him. Beloved, we are God's children now, and what we will be has not yet appeared. But we know that when he appears, we shall be like him, because we shall see him as he is. We'll get to see God and not die. Because Jesus is pulling us, pulling our plane of existence, pulling us who are sons of Adam into the Elohim, into the other realm. This is redemptive history. This is the history of the world according to God, that there are two realms of existence. Both, I think, were broken. And God used himself, used Jesus to bring the realms together in the fullness of time. He's making all things new, both in the heavens and the earth. That's why Revelation doesn't just say there's going to be a new earth, but there will also be a new heaven. The two realms will be made perfect, will be made anew through Jesus. See, this is the revelation that I stumbled across. All these things have greater meaning, have greater power, have more depth to them. Now that I know what an Elohim is and I have new definitions of angel and a son of man. We're not done yet in this series. We've seen God's plan, God's purpose-driven life, if you will. Now, from here, we're going to start turning our attention to what was going on in the heavens. What happened with the Elohim? What's the interaction between maybe the fallen Elohim, if you want to call them that, and us? And why did God choose Israel? What's the importance of Israel? And does that have any impact on this two planes of existence talk? That and more next time on God of Gods. This is Dante Stack signing out. Peace be the journey.